Я никогда не менялся.
Что вы подразумеваете под словом?
А я под этим понимаю людей.
Не заявляли о своих национальных.
Не воевали, не оккупировали.
Я думаю, что это глупое решение и вредное.
Я не друг и не невеста.
Я президент Российской Федерации.
He brushed off criticism of the Crimea annexation by saying international borders don't matter, only people. He suggested the countries of Eastern Europe have limited sovereignty. And he indicated that Russia would be willing to grant political asylum to Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. Vladimir Putin got 2016 rolling and gave Russia watchers plenty to talk about with a lengthy, wide-ranging, and sometimes contentious interview with the German tabloid Bild. In many ways, it was Putin's New Year's message to the West. So what was the Kremlin leader trying to tell us? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark, and Happy New Year.
Hi there, and the same to you.
And also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. Welcome back, Vladimir. Happy new and old new year.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. So there's a lot to chew on and unpack in this interview, which comes amid speculation as to whether Putin will attend the Munich Security Conference next month. Some of it was predictable fare. Everything would have been fine and all right between Russia and the West if NATO had only not enlarged and blah, blah, blah. Some of it was a clear appeal to elements of Germany who are sympathetic to Russia. Some of it was truly disturbing, like the claim that international borders don't matter in countries where ethnic Russians live. And some of it appeared to be a fig leaf to the West, for example, the suggestion that Moscow might give Assad asylum. I wanted to get started by asking both of you what your big takeaway from this was. What was the meta message Putin was trying to send here? Mark, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think two things really sort of come up. One is, I think he genuinely actually wants some kind of a pragmatic rapprochement with the West. I mean, look, in fairness, he didn't say the borders don't matter where ethnic Russians live. I mean, he very much sort of tried to play the Kosovo card to rationalize Crimea. But again,
He said, borders are not important to me, only people. Those are his direct words. That's what
precisely
he said.
What
and then he went on to talk about how ethnic Russians were being oppressed in Crimea, which is not true, but he said it. And so I don't know. I don't think I was unfair to Putin there at all, Mark.
Well, no, but I mean, he didn't actually just simply say that there's a special thing about ethnic Russians and wherever ethnic Russians are. I mean,
all right, well, let's leave that part out of it. Saying international borders don't matter is pretty damn disturbing.
He very much made the point about, you know, I mean, again, it's the classic point. He made played the Kosovo card. Which has been, you know, Russia's, I mean, I think genuinely held, but also very, very convenient get-out-of-jail-free card. I mean, you know, he touched on various notes. He said that he'd like to cooperate with NATO more. He doesn't think Russia should be a superpower, but on the other hand, what does a regional power mean? No, I think this is it. Point one is that I think he genuinely wants a sort of pragmatic rapprochement. But the trouble is, and I think this is really where the obstacle comes, is I think what really comes out is he believes the things he says. This is not just simply a convenient talking point to play. You know, I mean, for example, this point about Crimea. Yeah, of course, he has to rationalize and justify it. He can't just simply say, well, we saw an opportunity and by God, we're going to take it. Law be damned. But at the same time, I mean, I actually think that what came across was a man who believes in various things about the sort of essentially the way that Russia has been badly treated. It's interesting when he was asked, you know, what did everyone do wrong in the 1990s? What the West did wrong was, as it were, what the West actively did. You know, it didn't want to reach a deal with Russia. It didn't treat Russia separately. This is a very nice phrase about where he says that NATO and the USA wanted a complete victory over the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
They wanted to sit on the throne in Europe alone. You know, I think he genuinely believes that. And then when he was asked, well, okay, what did Russia do wrong? He essentially said, well, the point is Russia just didn't kind of present its point of view well enough and quickly enough, and we were too concerned.
It didn't assert itself enough and effectively enough, I believe, was what what he said.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he does say explain and so forth. So I think this is, you know, he genuinely thinks that really Russia has been hard done by, and I think this is the absolute obstacle that, you know, his head knows he needs to make a deal with the West of some kind, but I don't think ultimately his heart will let him talk meaningfully.
Mm. Now, this is along the lines of having read, Vladimir, your excellent piece in Sloan this week. You said Putin is basically taking on the role of an angry moralist who considers the outside world a family drama of love, hate, and betrayal. I'm quoting you with my hopefully accurate translation there. Can you expand on that a little bit? And also, what did you see? What was your big takeaway here? Was it a pragmatic reconciliation with the West?
Well, let me just for the record, the angry moralist terminology and the family feud view of world politics is not my idea. I quote Ivan Krastev.
Ivan Krastev, yes.
Who did an excellent piece in the New York Times and yesterday on Bloomberg View.
Yes.
So that's not me speaking, making this point, but I.
But you were quoting it.
Agree with
him.
It. Yeah. I quote him, and I generally agree with him. You know what strikes me about this interview and previously about this world order feature on Russian television. He clearly feels the need to explain himself to the world, to explain the actions he had taken in 2014-2015 with regard to Ukraine and later on with regard to Syria. And I agree with Mark that he in his head, he wants to go back to business as usual with the West, probably along the lines of how the West and Russia managed to put the Georgia War of 2008 behind them and quickly move to business as usual. That, I think, was the point. Now, the fact that he chose build prompted me to believe that he was really preparing himself to go to the Munich Security Conference, but now I'm being privately told that he probably wouldn't go.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask because right in the interview he said, "I will not go to Munich."
Right.
There was no ambiguity there.
Right. I still think that there was some preparation for some kind of a bold political statement. And the interview clearly serves this purpose. The problem I see with it is that, and this goes back to Mark's point about the heart not letting the head do the right thing. And the point is that the interview's messaging is, it's a very shoddy PR job.
Yeah.
The messaging is to use the, the high-flying British word discombobulated. And it goes all in different and contrary directions. And frankly, I'm really surprised that they allowed the interview to go this way. He clearly wants to mend things up, to patch things up with the West without... But that is a very important point. Without Russia having to do the legal redress, to apologize for the things that Russia did in 2014 in Ukraine, he wants to go back to the West on terms that, well, let's just forget about it. Let's just forget about it and move on. We did what we did. We thought it was right to do the right thing to do. And let's move on. And that would be a fairly valid point. And I'm sure there'll be many buyers in the West if he just basically pressed on that point and said, well, Crimea was a special thing. That was a one-off event. We're never going to do anything like this again. That's a very special case to us. Please understand it. We'll try to reach a deal with Ukraine and somehow patch things up. That would be a straightforward,
no, I think you're
clear
right.
Message.
He'd find some buyers for that in the West.
That would have worked. But he immediately inserts this "wars are not important" kind of thing, And it just trashes the entire purpose of the interview.
And also,
he goes into no-go land for Germans in particular.
Yeah.
That's amazing how they didn't see that, how this message would be received in the West is just, baffles me.
This is something that's baffled me from the start of all of this. And I've said this before, probably on this podcast. I've said it in many different forms. And it's just one of the mind-blowing things for me about the last 2 years is how Putin didn't get that all this wasn't going to freak out the Germans. He really was counting on the Germans to continue carrying his water. And with the first territorial land grab in Europe since World War II, there's no way the Germans could do that. There's just no way. Now, he was playing to a German audience in a lot of ways in this. The invocation of Egon Bahr, the father of Auspolitik, was a clear play to the kind of pro-Russian lobby in Germany. But that's going to be overshadowed, as you point out, Vladimir, by all the other things that came out in this. Marx says that he truly believes the things he says, Vladimir. Do you? I tend to think he does too. Do you think he does? Does he really believe these things he's saying, or is this just an attempt at a PR job?
That I do not know.
What's your instinct tell you?
I have no idea, really.
Because
it's tempting to say that he deeply believes in those things. Well, perhaps, I don't know. As a former PR guy, I tend to view it, instrumentally. And obviously, there was something his advisors, and particularly his savvy press people, could have done better in structuring this interview. He just veers off message.
Yeah.
Veers off message. He introduces this really wild notion of justice or just in international relations, saying, if we do the thing that we think is just, and he misquotes Napoleon, or
right.
mistranslates Napoleon. Napoleon was talking about a single justice system in a country, in France. He introduces this wild notion that, that's going to freak out everybody. Perhaps the Japanese would gladly welcome it because of the northern territories, which I think is a just issue for them to claim. Why they allowed him to deviate from message is just amazing. And another problem that I see with the interview is that, as Krastev clearly and justifiably points out, it's just a litany of grievances. He comes across as someone who is, he's listing sour grapes. He's grieving a loss, and at the same time, he does not propose anything. I mean, as I put it in my piece, in the good old Soviet times, and we are clearly trying to emulate many of the good things that the Soviet times brought us. In the good old Soviet times, every Soviet leader, if he grants a major interview to a Western media outlet, he introduces a major peace initiative for the Western audience to pick up and to talk about. Putin doesn't say anything about this. He doesn't introduce any new initiatives. And what strikes you as you finish up the interview is the question, what is Russia proposing constructively? What does Russia propose to engage the West with? What is the positive agenda, as the Kremlin?
But I think ultimately that speaks to the fact that there isn't a positive agenda. I mean, again, I really think two things. One is that sort of actually Putin's agenda is just leave us be, let us do our thing, go away. He'd like to declare independence from the world. But again, this also is one of the reasons why I think he actually believes what he believes. I mean, either one has to assume that this was somehow kind of choreographed as messaging, and that they were astonishingly stupid in how they decided to message. And we know that not everyone within the sort of the presidential administration is a complete imbecile, but they somehow thought, I know what's really going to work is precisely we'll talk to a sort of a major German mass circulation outlet
tabloid,
and we'll just grumble a lot, And that kind of grumpy old man approach will win everyone's hearts. I mean, either they thought that, or this is actually the real Putin speaking. And I think this actually speaks to a sort of a much wider political issue. You know, this idea of, you know, how could they allow the interview to have gone this way? I feel increasingly that Putin isn't handled. Putin isn't managed. Putin doesn't actually sit there and let people around him give him file cards with all his talking points. I think Putin feels he can just go in there. I mean, I'm sure he does some homework, but you know that he just goes in there and indulges himself, and this is what we get.
Well, I mean, if you contrast this to the to his Munich speech years ago, which, you know, shocked the world, but everybody was talking about it, but it accomplished the PR message that it set out to do. And if you contrast this, I mean, Mark, if you say he's not being handled, that implies he was being heavily handled back then.
Well, not so. I mean, handled implies, as it were, control. But let me put it. But particularly, I think back then, exactly, he would listen to, and he would go to the foreign ministry and other places and bring in outside experts, and precisely everything would be handled the way that you'd expect a major. Sort of not just a foreign policy initiative, but shall we say a major foreign policy outing. Whereas this just felt just like he just got up one morning, put his suit on, and just went down and chatted to the Bild people.
Right.
Yeah. Sounds plausible, but that doesn't. That doesn't eliminate the PR disaster that we're dealing with.
And you do consider this an unmitigated PR disaster, Vladimir?
I think so, yes.
Is that how it's being played in Russia?
No, it's being played as a major success. Like all mitigated disasters are.
Because one of the ways I look at this, I mean, if you look at the objective situation, I mean, the economy is clearly heading over a cliff. I mean, oil dipped below 30 today. The rubles crossed 77 to the dollar. And this trend is only going to continue. There's got to be a lot of, I would say, pressure on Putin to seek a rapprochement with the West. And to get relief from this, but he just can't seem to bring himself to do what would be necessary to get that. Can you see this interview as kind of reflecting those two trends, like where Putin, the aggrieved moralist, and the objective need to do something to break out of this impasse? Would you say that that's pretty much what happened here, Vladimir?
Well, I think Mark is right. You know, he just goes out one morning and essentially vents out his anger, and he's not really being controlled. Although there was some preparation going into this interview. Sure, he is under pressure to patch things up with the West, and he clearly is trying to do this, but. The format, the messaging, the kind of things he says produces the, if not the opposite effect, but they do not allow him to reach his objective. And whether he does not understand that he's failing in reaching those objectives, it just baffles me. I don't really know. Clearly, he wants to patch up things without, and that's very important politically inside Russia. He doesn't really want to plead with the West. He doesn't really want to appear that he's buckling up under Western pressure. So he has to go out and produce an impression of strength, and he kind of succeeds that. But then again, when he comes across as a grumpy old man who reiterates the old grievances and doesn't propose anything new, it's not exactly an image of strength that he produces.
Right.
Clearly, objectively, the situation calls for some rapprochement, but that requires compromise, and he doesn't offer much in terms of compromise for the West, with the exception of mentioning that he's entertaining the notion of granting political asylum to Assad, which would not be out of the question. That's probably the only the only give that he makes.
Yeah, and that was even tentative the way he did that. If Assad lost the election, then we would consider
Right, because he wants to keep the options open.
Right.
If things go his way and the offensive is successful, then Assad doesn't really have to go. He might actually win the election.
Right. Now, this all comes amid another context, too. If you saw the report in Kommersant this morning, supposedly Victoria Nuland is going to Kaliningrad to hold talks with Surkov about implementation of Minsk and the Ukraine crisis, or is reportedly maybe going to Kaliningrad. At the time I'm in the studio right now, I don't know if this is actually happening or not. Do you have any more? She is in Kaliningrad right now.
Right.
Okay, good. And that comes after Obama's phone call with Putin. So we do seem to have some movement on the Ukraine issue. Is this an indication that things could be moving despite this PR disaster?
Well, again, we need to do it to see the specifics.
Mm-hmm.
In his interview, he doesn't yield much ground on Ukraine.
None at all. Zero.
None at all. He reiterates standard fare. And I think basically right now the position is that we probably can force the Ukrainians. We can leverage the West to force the Ukrainians to accept our interpretation of the Minsk II, and which is to accept the republics within Ukraine. Whether that succeeds, I don't really know, but I don't think that has changed. I don't think we're talking about a wholesale redrafting of the Russian position.
Right. And judging from Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's remarks yesterday, I don't see the Ukrainian position being revised one inch either.
So what's the give? We really need to know the substance, which we are not privy to, of what transpired between Gryzlov and Poroshenko, and what is now transpiring between Nuland and Surkov. But that's
and what transpired between Obama and Putin on the phone this week
right.
as well.
Right. The official readout from the Kremlin is standard fare.
Right.
Putin
and from
doesn't
the White House
yield
too.
Any ground. I think reintroduction of Surkov is significant because, you know, we had Nuland Karasin format. She used to meet her counterpart, actually, and a very capable, brilliant Russian diplomat, Grigory Karasin.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's talking to the presidential assistant, president's right-hand man. That elevates the discussion to an entirely new level.
Right.
But again, Surkov is pretty much hardline on eastern Ukraine.
Yeah.
I don't think Surkov would yield any ground on the republics. Mm. I think the problem with the settlement is that Russia wants the republics as structured to be integrated into Ukraine. And Poroshenko wants actually the republics to be dismantled and then reintegrate the regions. The local authorities.
Right, and neither shows any sign of
I don't see any signs right now.
I mean, I think, Vladimir, you raised an interesting point earlier about how basically they want a repeat of the post-Georgia war scenario. We're talking about the reset. Now, that's not in the offing. But, Mark, what do you think? What is in the offing now? Where can this go in terms of relations between Russia and the West, where Putin clearly wants us to forget about what's happened the last 2 years and basically do what happened in 2009, 2010. What can we expect short of that?
Well, let's face it, at the moment, it's very hard to see much scope for that. And I think in some ways, the problem is as soon as Putin actually comes back into the mix. I mean, it has to be said that there were a few more sort of conciliatory notes in his build interview, but the point is exactly they just got completely wasted because they were then overtaken by all the bad stuff. I mean, he makes the point that every state, and he's talking about the East Central European ones, has the right to organize its own security the way it deems appropriate. He says that Assad, he said also things that Assad has done wrong in the course of the conflict, which again is actually a step forward. But this is it. A few little positive grace notes completely drowned out by all the problematic dimension of his. And so I think, you know, even if we take someone like Surkov, clearly, yes, he is indeed quite hard line on the issue. issue. But on the other hand, he is also much more of a, to be blunt, a wheeler dealer. If you look at what the Russian Foreign Ministry has been working on in terms of its relations with the West, I mean, I was almost tempted to think it's a classic technique of Lavrov's to basically start his meetings with Kerry or whatever with a great litany, a barrage of these kind of complaints, much like Putin's interview.
Mm-hmm.
Which are as many things. I mean, it is like artillery to soften up before the assault, because then he then plans to move into the second part. You know, having hammered the other side, you then try and see where the negotiations are, and you use this as an opportunity to sort of, as it were, build a proper position for that. Whereas Putin just did the first half, and then it's thanks very much. See you in another 10 years. I mean, I think this is actually. Putin is demonstrating that whatever his capacities may be, Putin is not a diplomat manqué by any standards.
Right.
And so it's almost like, actually, I get the sense that there are elements within the apparatus that are trying to find small points of purchase. But again, we come back to the business of Putin and his emotions. I mean, Vladimir was quite right about saying this, you know, that his presentation at the building was very much about strength. Putin cannot allow himself to appear weak. This was part of the whole Syria thing, was hoping that to get enough leverage that basically the West would allow him to be able to sort of reach some kind of a deal in Ukraine that he wouldn't have to look bad with. I don't exactly see Victoria Nuland as an easy pushover, and about to give Putin any sort of free points. So I mean, I think we're still at the point of a lot of frankly very primal macho posturing, and when it comes down to it, in this respect, I mean, although I don't think that, you know, the Russian economy is heading for collapse or anything like that, but certainly. Except in maybe very, very long-term things. I mean, time is not certainly on Putin's side.
Mm.
And in that respect, again, I think here we have this issue that from Europe's point of view, I think there are many people who are just uncomfortable with conflict, who would like to sort of try and bring Russia back into the fold on some, and absolutely, if they got what would seem like a halfway decent deal, they were probably willing to make some kind of compromises with Russia. But firstly, that's not, I think, the perspective in the United States, and I think it's not going to be the perspective in the United States. Again, I think
regardless of who wins the elections, regardless of who wins that election.
Well, yeah, but even just simply in the run up to the elections, no one's going to sort of, you know, in the White House is going to say, oh well, you know, why don't we just give Putin an easy hand of it? Quite the opposite, they have nothing really to lose. So. United States isn't going to go there, but more to the point, I mean, I don't think Putin even can seem to bring himself to handing Europe that halfway decent, halfway acceptable deal. I mean, as Vladimir said, he didn't say anything conciliatory over Ukraine. You know, his messaging throughout, not just in this interview, has actually been very not so much. I wouldn't say confrontational, because, you know, he says, "Oh, we want to be peaceful," but absolutely unyielding. More mm-hmm. to the point, he holds out no promise, and I think from those point of view, from the Western European point of view, there is really little sense that it's actually even worth putting any political capital into reaching some kind of a deal with him.
Yeah, no, and I'd add to that, Mark, where you see even the conciliatory points he made, and you noted the statement that the countries of Central and Eastern Europe have the right to organize their own security. It's odd that should be seen as a concession. That's kind of axiomatic for me. But he follows up on that they shouldn't have been allowed to join NATO, which, as Vladimir, you pointed out in your Sloan piece, sounded a bit like the Brezhnev Doctrine, with the principle of limited sovereignty. Right. Even the conciliatory points, even themselves, were kind of mitigated by confrontational points. I just think we're at an impasse, and we're not going to be able. There's no way to break this.
I think Mark found a very apt term to describe Putin's message: unyielding. It's not confrontational, clearly, and that's a positive thing. He's not confrontational, but he's unwilling to yield an inch of the mm-hmm. Russian position.
Vladimir, before we move on to the second half, do you think that's sustainable given where the Russian economy appears to be going? It may not be headed for collapse, but it's headed for a very bad place.
I should not link it with the economy. I think it's sustainable inside Russia for Putin to maintain that position. In fact, that's the only position, given the trouble in the on the economic side, it's the only position that would keep him incredibly popular and on top of any political trouble that he might get into due to economic circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I think that explains this unyielding position. He wants to present to the Russians the image of a very strong, unyielding leader who essentially can stand his ground with regard to the West. The Russians love it.
And that's not going to change regardless of how bad the economy gets, how low the ruble sinks, how low oil prices go, how much the budget has to be cut, how much living standards fall.
I don't think that's going to happen with Putin.
So the refrigerator will never beat the television?
Not for the foreseeable future.
Mark, would
the
you
refrigerator
agree?
Isn't even on the television. I mean, this is the thing is where if you look at the print media, there's a lot about the economy. There's a lot of sort of, you know, even people raising issues about like the defense budget and such like. Watching TV, though, certainly the first half of it's all foreign news. It's all about migration crisis in the West or Syria or whatever. You know, and again, I mean, in this respect, again, it's just depressing sort of throwback to an extent to the Brezhnev days, where actually the response to "we are hungry here in Murmansk" was but they're starving in Manchester.
Right.
It's actually sort of, if you can't sell a particularly good narrative about your own country, at least you try and sell a very bad narrative about everyone else.
Well, the refrigerator's not.
Brian,
yeah, sure.
Another important point, I think, is because of the economic difficulties, once they made foreign policy the major source of their internal political support and legitimacy, they can very ill afford to appear weak mm-hmm. on foreign policy, to suffer a foreign policy defeat. That's what they fear more than economic difficulties.
Mm.
And that's probably explains the unyielding position.
Right. No, but the thing is, I mean, the television, the refrigerator is not on the television. That's for sure. But the refrigerator certainly is in the kitchen. And people are starting to notice the refrigerator more. And unlike Soviet days, people know a better life now, right? They know a better life. They know that they're not starving in Manchester because they've been to Manchester, right? So isn't this going to be harder to sell now?
Well, unless we get to the point where, which we see in Venezuela, mm-hmm. you know, people lining for toilet paper. And I don't think that we will get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that happens, I don't think the refrigerator threatens television in the foreseeable future.
Okay, well, we'll watch and see. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and shift from foreign affairs to court politics and look at the dire warning a former Putin insider issued this week to Russia's ruling class. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's temporarily embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
В интервью агентству Bloomberg
Владимир Якунин.
Есть близкое окружение
говорят,
Путина.
Что в Кремле в окружении Путина есть две группы.
Это Путин и его окружение.
Ну, в общем, да, продолжится ротация.
Окружение Путина не делится на голубов, на голубей.
You may think your wealth, privilege and power are inalienable rights, but everything you have depends on the whims of one man, and it can be taken away at any moment. That was the message of longtime Putin crony Vladimir Yakunin, who was sacked as head of Russian Railways in August. In the interview, Yakunin also said that Putin's inner circle will, quote, continue to rotate, suggesting a potential shakeup of the elite. The respected Russian sociologist Olga Krishnovskaya, who studies the Russian elite, also told Bloomberg that a purge was coming to Putin land. Mark, is court politics about to make a comeback?
Well, let's just start with talking about Yakunin, who He might want to try and throw the mantle of Khodorkovsky over himself, but let's be perfectly honest.
Oh, I did this week on the Daily.
Oh, no, no. But, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I must admit, when I was looking at that interview, I was thinking, dear God, you're trying to make out that you are somehow hard done by. Whereas, in fact, you know, he just simply was basically either was forced or encouraged to resign. He may no longer be able to continue to stuff his head in the trough. But no one has come to take his
fur closet,
his mansion with his fur, exactly with his fur sort of closet away, that kind of thing. And in some ways, actually, if Yakunin does get away with it, perversely, although it sticks in my craw to suggest it, that might be a good thing. In that you want the elite to be able to feel that they have the opportunity to, shall I say, retire or be retired without having to lose everything and therefore having to fight to the death. In terms of whether a purge is coming, it's very hard to tell. I mean, unfortunately,
is court politics coming back? I'm not sure if a purge is coming, but court politics is something I'm going to be watching this year, which seemed to disappear from the radar the last couple of years.
Well, I would suggest in a way that there's two contradictory forces, and the outcome will depend or will demonstrate which of those forces is dominant. One is the lockdown, the we are assailed, we all have to sort of pull together, we must show that a united front, which is basically the whole kind of Fortress Russia sort of model. However, at the same time, we see that the elite, from my point of view, are on the whole not, whatever rhetorical flourishes they may sort of demonstrate, are not actually behind the Putin, I don't know, whatever you call it, empire building, Russia 2.0, whatever, the ideological project. They are just simply acquisitive kleptocrats. And I think we do see a certain amount of jostling. You know, we've seen it over, you know, control of hydrocarbon industries. And just generally, I mean, I think we may well actually see the continuance of the jostles between institutions, between kleptocrats, between oligarchs, call them what you will. And you might say if the jostling becomes too visible, it says something about the fact that their fear of their own business empires being diminished is greater than their fear of Putin. If, on the other hand, ultimately people do stay in lockstep, then it shows that their fear of Putin is greater than anything else. Right. But I think it is fear that keeps them there. It just that in a way, they fear that they can lose their business empires one of two ways, because Putin takes it away from them or because economics takes it away from them.
No, I was an interesting comment along these lines. Valery Solovey, the professor at MGMO, the maverick professor at MGMO, that I'm always amazed is allowed to say the things publicly that he says. He says basically the elite is a hostage to Putin, but basically has Stockholm syndrome. And I thought that summed it up nicely. But a couple of the reasons why I think court politics might be making a comeback this season is first of all, the rumors of Kudrin's return, which would not be universally welcomed in Putin land. It would be universally welcomed by readers of Viedomosti and Sloan, probably, but it wouldn't be universally welcomed by the Sechins and Ivanovs of the world. That's one reason. The other is that we're starting to see rumors of potential privatizations of banks and oil companies. This is something else that came out in the news this week, which the immediate thought I had was, oh my God, this sounds like loans for shares all over again. And one has to wonder now if the jostling among the clans in the court is going to start anew and this facade of unity is going to fade away. Am I right, Vladimir, or am I barking up the wrong tree here?
Oh, I'm afraid it's also a bit premature. My reading of Yakunin's interview is that the man who was eased out of his inner circle position with Putin by more competitive and more aggressive takers like Rotenbergs, for example. Mm-hmm. I think he wants to make himself useful again and to regain some position of favor with Putin. And that's his message, that he's going to set up this think tank and start influencing Western public opinion, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. One has to remember that he immediately disavowed his comments to Bloomberg, saying that Bloomberg distorted the core message of the interview by this phrase.
If it comes to believing Bloomberg News or Vladimir Yakunin, I think I'm pretty clear which one of those two I'm going to believe.
Right. But clearly he tried to do some damage control, and obviously that message didn't sit well in the Kremlin. So if he wanted to get back inside the inner circle, he hasn't, narrowed the distance.
Why didn't he take his? Why, if he was seeking a new role, why did he not take his seat in the Fed Council? I mean, that was a little bit puzzling to me.
Well, because he would have taken the seat council if he were at least offered the position of first deputy speaker.
Right, right.
With the prospect of later on unseating Valentina Matviyenko. But that was not an offer, and he clearly got offended. He showed off his offense by rejecting the offer, clearly demonstrating that his position in society and his relationship with Putin allows him to be important and influential without this, sinecura seat in the Federation Council that doesn't amount to much.
Right. Mark, I love your formulation of the three Russias, basically, the normal Russian state, the kleptocratic Russian state, and the ideological Russian state. I wanted to kind of pick up on something you said earlier about the way Yakunin was removed might be a good precedent that people in the elite could be retired in a more or less civilized way where they don't lose everything. Do you think maybe this is a model for a potential, maybe albeit tepid, attack on corruption and attack on the kleptocracy?
Well, I think it's two separate things. One is the issue of this sort of attack on corruption, and the other one is this as a model. At the moment, unfortunately, I think Yakunin is an outlier rather than a model. The point is, Yakunin had so much social capital built up that, as it were, even though he was indeed outmaneuvered by people with more economic but above all social/political capital, nonetheless, he could trade that into having a fairly sort of comfortable landing. But I don't think it's that, as it were, being regarded as the norm. I just think it's that's what he happened to spend some of his spare capital on. But on the other hand, I mean, I do think that there is sort of signs of a potential new drive against corruption, which again is pretty much a sort of an annual tradition. So it could just simply be that it's no more significant than just putting up the Christmas trees. It's just part of the sort of the usual cycle of life. But I mean, we have the Chaika story about
staying
Naval
in the news.
Case. Exactly, staying in the news, and not just staying in the news. I mean, okay, no one's actually coming out necessarily and saying Chaika is corrupt, but whereas usually this will be dropped, it's sort of the whole sort of account is being kept there, and it's been kept even in papers like Izvestia, which are very, very close to, it's almost slavishly close to the government. Therefore, I don't tend to think that the words Maverick
well,
and Izvestia.
Well, in Izvestia's case, to Putin personally.
Yeah, that's true. But we're also, I mean, we have a pretty much a kind of a daily diet of someone not, we're not talking about a minister or whatever, but nor are we talking about, third assistant dog catcher. Someone of some clout within the regions getting arrested, an ex-senator here. I mean, my particular favorite was the head of the prison service in Colney.
Who stole a road.
Stole 50 kilometers of road. Exactly.
That was right out of Gogol. I mean,
there is a certain ingenuity to that. But, but again, in some ways, the very fact that it's actually a fun story, it gives it legs. It means it's there. It's actually, it's in the news. It's being recounted. And it's in the it's not just in Commerçant or whatever.
Right.
It's in the more tabloid end of the news as well. So I think, we either. It just happens to be one of those things, which is unlikely. Or else there certainly is a sort of a growing willingness to actually sort of say that there are people out there who are corrupt and the state is doing something about it. I mean, I think because this is, I think, the sort of the funny and delicate balance. On the one level, the more you talk about corruption, the more you risk delegitimizing the state. But on the other hand, you actually have to be going out there and visibly fighting corruption to try and re-legitimize the state, given that everybody knows corruption is that. So it's a question of whether or not the state can tread that balance. I don't believe it can, personally. But nonetheless, I have a feeling that they might be gearing up for an attempt to try and walk that tightrope.
Well, the way Putin's always tried to thread this needle was with Potemkin anti-corruption drives. But now it's getting to the point where economics demands. I mean, I said on the Daily Vertical this morning, if you look at the big picture and you get away from the minutiae of this year's budget and whether they're going to cut 10% or however many percent, and look at really what they have to do, they're not going to cut military because that basically Putin's legitimacy is based on Russia's military revival. You have basically either curb the kleptocracy or balance or on the backs of the Russian people. And I strongly suspect it's going to be the latter. Vladimir, do you see a real anti-corruption?
Okay, can I just the military thing, just two quick points. One is, I mean, actually, Russia could afford to cut its defense budget quite substantially without in any way affecting the kind of activities that Putin is re-legitimizing himself with. You know, you could still have your little power projection into Syria. You can still actually kick the stuffing out of the Georgians or whatever, and yet have a smaller defense budget. I mean, I think we have to realize the extent to which it's actually almost, it's not about the legitimization. It's almost as if actually this has become a totemistic issue for Putin. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. second thing is actually also fighting corruption is part of security. And it's quite interesting that with the issuance of a new national security strategy, you know, which actually is much more broadly conceptualized in Russia. I mean, this is something that Putin signed into act in the very last day of the last year.
Right.
You know, but actually, if one looks at the extent to which corruption is affecting Russia's security posture, ranging from the fact that its new cosmodrome is proving ridiculously inefficient to be built, to the fact that significant amounts of the procurement budget get stolen. I mean, that's another one of the potential crux points, is when he actually sees corruption as not a positive force which coheres the elite, which is, I think, really how he's seen it up to now, but actually as something that is also beginning to undermine mm-hmm. domestic and internal security.
Vladimir, your thoughts on all this?
Well, I would say that Yakunin's message is essentially rally around the flag. It's a message to call upon the elite to coalesce around Putin. Mm. I think he one of the most disturbing things that he says is that he basically says there is no elite, you know, there is no elite in terms of the cadre of people who put the interests of the state above their role.
Yeah. Well, he said there's
yet to be developed.
It's not like in Tsarist times, I thought was the
right.
interesting
that,
way
that,
he formulated
that. That was his
that.
Message, essentially saying that, well, I'm probably the one who fits this criteria, but everybody else does not. But again, it's a fair point. It's a fair point. Mm. And he tries to sell this message to President Putin. Mm. Whether he will find a buyer, I'm not sure about this.
Right. One other thing I wanted to hit on before we wrapped up is the Kudrin rumors. That appear to be have a little more substance behind them than in previous times. What are we to make of this, Vladimir? What's your take on all of these rumors that Kudrin's gonna be?
Well, for one thing, that's been shut down. They said they couldn't find a place for him, and clearly the only position he aspires to is the prime ministership.
Well, there was talk of him coming into the Kremlin as an economic advisor. He clearly didn't want a place in the cabinet under Medvedev, but there was talk of him potentially coming into the Kremlin.
To do what? To do sparring fights with Belousov and Glazev? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's something that Kudrin aspires to.
He wants to
do policy, not to advise on policy, and the advice would never be taken up on.
What do you think was behind it all, though? Because this went on for a while. It seemed to have a little bit of substance behind it.
Well, I think there are clearly some discussions Kudrin is having with President Putin. And clearly Putin would have loved to give Kudrin some executive functions or some advisory functions. But not the ones that Kudrin would feel comfortable with.
Mm.
And I think the only position Kudrin wants to have is Medvedev's job. and that's not an offer due to previous commitments. Mm-hmm. And that's the conundrum we have. Clearly, some people are arguing, there has to be a strong prime minister and a strong government in the times of the crisis. And probably Kudrin or Gref would have been a much stronger prime minister. But that's not entertained, as far as I understand.
Because of the commitments Putin made to Medvedev in 2010.
I think because of the commitments and because of probably some future plans that we're not really aware of.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what was your take on all of this?
Yeah, I'd very much agree with what Vladimir said. I'd also, I think I'd add, I mean, and obviously in some ways one can link the Medvedev and Yakunin stories in that actually a central leitmotif is that Putin is loyal to his own. Yakunin may have been outmaneuvered from his position, but he's still doing very nicely. You know, a lot of other people who fall foul of bigger, sharper-toothed, sharper-elbowed rivals do not have anything like the same kind of latitude. And likewise, you know, Medvedev, however much one may joke about him, he has done his job. He has actually sort of held true to what Putin expected of him, and I think likewise Putin feels a commitment to him. But also, I mean, I think, you know, let's be honest, there's no way that Kudrin would think of himself as a new Medvedev. Kudrin would want to be a real prime minister, right. Not just the sort of, you know, the little wooden boy. And if one thinks of what kind of economic policy making Kudrin would want to bring in, it would be hard, I think, to reconcile that with the massive feather bedding of certain people, certain interests, certain industries. It will be hard to reconcile that with the kind of allowance of the extraordinary inefficiencies still found within aspects of the Russian defense industrial complex. And it will be hard to reconcile that with the defense spend. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing is, it's not just Kudrin the person. And, you know, a lot of people respect Kudrin, and a lot of people know that it will be a wonderful fillip for Russia's sort of international financial credibility. But, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who actually don't like Kudrin particularly. But there's also, more to the point, a lot of people who fear what a Kudrin premiership would mean, and rightly so.
If he's allowed to do what he wants, because my fear was the opposite, that Kudrin would come in and basically have to be a mafia accountant.
I just don't think he'd be up for that.
Well,
I think this is why he would only take it, I might say, if he felt he had the promise that he could do what he felt he needed to do.
Well, I think,
and
this,
if he felt that wasn't being allowed, he would walk.
No, and I think this is more the impasse than the question over what position he's going to be in. I think the impasse is, if Kudrin wants to be prime minister, like you said, he wants to be a real prime minister. If he's in the Kremlin run as the chief economic advisor, he wants to actually really have what he's advising implemented, and that ain't going to happen in this system. I think they're just not going to square that circle. All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's temporarily embedded, has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Thanks. Always glad to have you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, editor-in-chief of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, who you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.